50 today, and that's the optative mood, and put at the end for a reason. It's not used very frequently, but it does appear enough to at least require you to recognize them. Fortunately, optative mood forms are quite easy to recognize, just because of the morphemes that are involved. So, in section 383, the optative mood is used very infrequently in the New Testament. The forms are indicated below. And all we have are present and aorist forms to worry about. Present active, present middle passive, aorist active, aorist middle, aorist passive. And looking at the paradigm, they're really quite easy to recognize. The present active for luo would be luoi mi, luois, luoi, luoi men, luoi te, luoi en. Present middle and passive for luo would be luoi men, luoio, luoito, luoimetha, luoiste, luointo. And we've seen the ending system before. And now we're seeing a different stem formative here, the omicron iota stem formative. Now the aorist, we tend to have all the iotas all the way through. And the aorist active, we see lusai mi, lusais, lusai, lusai men, lusaita, lusaien. Notice we've got our sigma again as we had before. We don't have an augment, and that's quite typical of anything other than indicative. And we've got a thematic alpha iota rather than the omicron iota. Now we've already seen omicrons associated with present forms of more than, and alphas associated with aorist. So if you just add an iota to both of those, it kind of makes sense. The first aorist middle, we have lusai main, lusio, lusaito, lusaimatha, lusaista, and lusainto. And aorist passive, luthein, lutheis, luthea, lutheamen, lutheate, and lutheasan. That's similar to what we've seen before. Actually, aorist passes before, we had luthein, luthes, etc. If you just put another S, an A in there, an epsilon iota in there between the others, you pretty much have it. Yes? Yeah, it looks something like that, that with that epsilon iota there. It's looking like...
For the nominative.
Uh-huh. At least for the nominative there before things get changed. It might be good to think of that as an association or something that you can associate with it to trigger your memory or something. Okay. Then section 384, forms other than regular verbs are indicated below. So when you get to irregular verbs, first of all, the second aorist active for lepo gets the stem change. And we've already seen this in the normal aorist for this. This was the second aorist. And so it's the second aorist in the optative. And the philosophy is pretty much the same as we've seen before. Basically, it reverts back to present type forms. And so you have a stem change from lip to lip, and then lipoi me, lipois, lipoi, lipoi men, lipoi, lipoi te, lipoi in, just like you had the presence. So that's analogous to what we've seen before. Second aorist middle, same thing, lipoi men. Lipoi mean, excuse me, lipoi o, lipoi to, lipoi mata, lipoi se, and lipoin to. Present optative of ame, that was just crazy. So there's no way to, you know, no way to predict that. In fact, it looks like aorist passive ending. The ending system on aorist passive is what you end up having. Aein, aes, aa, aamen, aate, aason. Okay, so that's kind of interesting. But that's the present optative now. That even though it looks like aorist passive, it's present. Okay. And then, but we've come to expect unusual things with the verb ame. Now, contracted forms of the optative do not occur in the New Testament, so you don't have to worry about those. And for the me verbs, only the following forms can be cited. So there's no sense in learning a paradigm for these. You got fewer forms if you just memorize all the ones in the New Testament than you do if you have a paradigm. So the present, middle, and passive of dunamai occurs. It's a deformant verb. And that is dunaimein. For the first person singular, that occurs. And the third person plural, dunaito. Those are the only two that occur in that verb. The aorist active of dido me occurs the singular third person singular form doe, and the aorist middle of onenemi, help, profit, or benefit, onaimen, occurs. So those are the only ones that are irregular me verbs and so forth that you find in the New Testament. Okay, so that's pretty easy. Then section 386, to break this down into the morpheme system again, the forms of the optative may be analyzed into morphemes laid down along the lines of section 164, 169 as follows. First the base, in this case lu, tense formants, sigma in the aorist active in the middle, and theta in the aorist passive, and that's first aorist passive, that's according to what we've seen before. Stem formatives, we have omicron iota in all voices of the present tense, excuse me, and the second aorist active in the middle. Okay, so in all voices of the present tense, you have this omicron iota, whether it's present or present, middle, and passive. Just present active or middle and passive forms. And for the, you also have the same thing in the second aorist active in middle, the omicron iota, reverse back to that. You have alpha iota in the first aorist active in middle, and then epsilon iota eta in the aorist passive, AA. Okay. Then the suffixes. You have primary A, no primary Bs for this one, secondary A's and secondary B's. Okay, we don't have any imperfect forms or anything like that, so we're not worried about primary B. But it gives a remark here. It gives the suffixes. Like I've said before, this may be more for interest than trying to memorize it. You're probably better off just memorizing the whole ending system. But remark, primary A suffixes given above are found in the present and first and second aorist optative active. The secondary A suffixes are found in the optative, the aorist optative passive. The secondary B suffixes are found in the present optative middle and passive, and in the first and second aorist optative middle. So it's just a matter of breaking down these things and giving an analogous ending layout to what you've seen before. Okay. I don't think there's too many questions on those. They're pretty easy forms to recognize. That omicron iota or that alpha iota makes them quite easy to recognize. Now the uses of the optative. What are these things for? Just like we've seen with subjunctive, the optative's got the is not indicative. It's not indicating a fact. It's dealing more with things in the realm of possibility, or wish or desire, expressing a wish or a desire. And that's what we see with the optative. First use of the optative. The optative is used in independent clauses to express a wish or prayer. A wish or a prayer. This is in independent clauses now, when it's standing by itself, not a part of a subordinate clause or something. And so we see in Luke 20:16, example, may genoito, may it not happen. Or King James always translates this, God forbid. I don't know where they get that, you know. The Greek is just may it never be, may it not be, may it not happen. So just from ginomai and then in the optative form here. May, of course, is the negative you're going to use with this too, because it's like subjunctive and so forth. It's the ones that are not indicative are going to get may. Yes?
Due to the fact that it's a negative construction, I'm wondering if the same way that the subjunctive is actually negative, or is it still kind of more of a possibility?
Yeah, it's still in the realm of possibility, I think. I think the main thing is it's just an ordinary negative, but the fact that the possibility is there in addition to that, that's kind of what you're getting on. You're getting more emphasis, but it's not just from the negative alone. The negative has just got a negative value, but then when you put the possibility, let there be no possibility, that's what makes it stronger.
Right.
Yeah.
So, are we seeing that here?
I think so. I think it's the same kind of thing. May it not happen is quite a powerful expression. Yeah. I mean, and it's usually used when there's a lot of emotional feeling about it. Right. You know, when Paul says, God, you know, the King James, wherever Paul, King James says, God forbid, that's Paul saying, may it never be. And it's quite a strong expression. It's saying, this it shall not be. But it comes from the fact that you get the negative plus the optative idea of making a strong wish. Okay. Then Philemon 20 has ego su oinaimen, may I benefit from you. And in the context there, this is kind of a takeoff on the name Onesimus, which meant profitable, the noun form, and then they're using this verb form, may I benefit from you. Paul is expressing very strong wish here. to see Onesimus set free as a slave. And you can see from the whole letter, he's putting a lot of loving pressure upon Philemon to do that. Yes?
That's the one example of that neighbor there that we mentioned on the previous.
Mm-hmm.
They call it an heiress middle. Are you saying the same thing concerning the heiress in this, that it doesn't show a past tense, but sort of an indefiniteness?
Yes, that's the thing. It's mainly an aspect difference again.
May I have that as a from you if it was, you know,
right.
Like an heiress?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the main idea here. It's almost always... you're going to see here, it's in the realm of possibility. It's not in the realm... See, when things are in the indicative, when you're making a statement, that's when tense ideas become important, because statements of fact are going to be time-oriented generally. But when it's not a statement of fact now, and you're dealing with wishes, possibilities, and so forth, then you're dealing with a kind of different realms. And so, yes, I think it's a fair analysis. It's a matter of aspect. And I've never, you know, I don't know if there's enough of these where anybody's taken a poll to see how often they're using the present, how often they're using the other, and if it's a clear progressive versus indefinite aspect. But I would expect that to be the case. We can just watch for these examples and see if there's anything that we might see here. These are, most of them look like they're using aorist.
So my next question was,
mm-hmm.
How often, you know, what do you
use? Yeah, I don't know. All I can do is look at the examples here. You don't see very, you know, he's covering pretty much most of the instances you find in the New Testament, not every single time, but the chief examples of it in the New Testament. There aren't very many to draw from. If you're going to use examples, you're going to have to pull from just about everything that's there. There is one, this Acts 17:18, what would this babbler wish to say? That's in the present. So it may be indicating what would this babbler wish to be saying. This other one, how would I be able, and this one guide me. Well, I'm kind of reading ahead here, but there's an aorist there. It looks like we've got both presence and aorist. The verb to be is almost automatically progressive. So that looks to be the distinction. Okay, but let's just kind of keep that in mind as we go through the rest of the examples, though. This 1 Timothy, or 1 Thessalonians 5:23, is expressing a wish. It's a prayer here. Paul is ending up the epistle with a prayer, an expression of his desire that they come into a certain place in God. So he says, "Ho theostes erenes hagiasai," and that's a optative form from hagiadzo. Humas holoteles kai holokleron hemon topnuma kai hesuke kai tosoma amemptos ente parousia tu kuriu hemon Jesu Christu tere thee. Now again, you see an optative form here, an aorist optative form. So the translation, may the God of peace sanctify you. So the word sanctify is in the optative. So you're getting, may he sanctify you, holy, and may your spirit and soul and body be kept. That last verb form would be, may they be kept. And that's the whole idea in aorist passive form there for that one. Okay. Then second category, the optative is used in independent clauses to express what would happen if some supposed condition were fulfilled. So this is getting you into kind of the potentiality. He mentions here that many of the textbooks use the traditional terminology of potential optative here. So it's expressing what would happen if some supposed condition were fulfilled. Now that supposed condition may sometimes not be stated, implied by the context, sometimes it may be stated also. The particle on always accompanies the optative when it's used with this meaning.
Okay.
Now, Acts 17:18, as an example, ti on theloi hos spermologos utos legain. What would this babbler wish to say? Okay, that is, if he can only manage it. That's the idea. Besides something. In other words, it's something that he would wish to say, but... for some reason he isn't, or isn't at that moment, so forth. So there's kind of an implied condition, that supposed condition that would be fulfilled, and then he'd be able to say it. So you're seeing the particle on and then the optative form thalloy. Acts 8:31, post gar on dunaimen on me tis hodegese me. For how would I be able unless someone will guide me? Okay, this is the Ethiopian eunuch on the chariot there and reading the scroll of Isaiah, and Philip comes to him and asks him if he understands what he's reading. He says, how would I be able unless someone will guide me? So again, it's here the condition is actually expressed, except someone guide me. The guiding is going to be necessary for him to understand is what he's saying. Okay. And again, it's hypothetical. And this one's using an aorist, so that sense to it. Then, thirdly, the optative, again, traditionally called a potential optative, may be used if the if clause of a conditional sentence, in the if clause of a conditional sentence, if it expresses a hypothetical assumption. So, when you're dealing with conditionals in which you're expressing a hypothetical assumption, then you're likely to see optatives. And so if clauses are, if and such clauses rendered by A. So it's similar to what we've seen before with our conditional clauses, but now we're seeing an optative being used there, and especially it's especially got a hypothetical sense to it. Acts 20:16, spudengar e dunaton a auto ten hemerites pentecostes genestai eith Jerusalem. For he was hasting to be in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost, if it were possible for him. A dunaton a auto. If it were possible for him, he was hasting, see, to be in there on the day of Pentecost. So it's a hypothetical situation, if it were possible. That kind of an idea, yes.
Is it stronger or how does that compare with the subjunctive?
Usually it's characterized this way. The subjunctive is dealing with probability, and this is dealing more with possibility. In other words, this seems to be a little bit more remote possibility than, you know, in situations like this, to compare the two. And most of the textbooks, you know, associate the subjunctive with probability and this one with possibility. And, of course, the difference between the two is just, you know, whether the chances are greater or less for it coming about. So that doesn't mean that when you use the optative, you don't expect it to happen. It just means that there's a lot more uncertainty about it. Mm-hmm.
I had a question on the standard there. Is that possible?
Yeah, it's probably considered here a predicate adjective to be possible, built from that verb dunamai. That's what it looks like. It's not a normal verb form. So you're using the verb to be with dunaton, and it looks like just a neuter form, either not, you know, a neuter nominative form of an adjective.
I was wondering why I thought it was accusative and also
was
dative.
No, see, auto is dative, but it could be dative. Well, that's possible for him, but see, if it were possible, it's kind of one of those impersonal things where the it is kind of a neuter idea. That's the way I would look at it. In other words, if it were possible for him. See, the auto for him is just is one of the oblique cases. In other words, it's dative. It's a kind of a prepositional phrase idea. So that's not intrinsically connected to the rest of this. If it were possible for him, the it, you have to understand an it being equated with possible. It was possible. See, and then if you have a hypothetical it that's not expressed, and then possible in the nominative case neuter, that would fit it. Okay. What? Any other question? All right. 1 Peter 3:14. Al a kai paskoite dia dikaio sunain makarioeste. But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you are blessed. Okay, here's a hypothetical again. If you should suffer, you are blessed. And again, this is not, it's dealing with possibility now, hypothetical, even if you should suffer. It's not expressing an impending expectation of suffering necessarily, like you might see with a subjunctive or something. But it's just dealing with a hypothetical possibility if you should suffer. And there's no necessary immediate expectation of that. See what I'm saying? So just hypothetically, if you should suffer, then you're blessed. So You might see another conditional where you might use a subjunctive. If you might suffer for his name, you'd be blessed, and it's just a little bit stronger. And then you might see a conditional clause, if you will suffer for his sake, or if you suffer for his sake, just using the indicative, and then make it even more strong possibilities. Because you've got lots of ability for shades of meaning in this. And I think it's well worth your while to pay attention when you see optative forms, since you don't see them very frequently, to see the difference between that and say what a subjunctive would be and so forth. And that's something we should watch for as we're translating too. A lot of these things are really good to kind of get your in your mind set ahead of time and be watching for to gain the kind of nuances that we need to have. All right, then fourth category, the optative may be used in subordinate clauses after introductory verbs of saying, etc., in past tenses, in indirect discourse, representing an original indicative or subjunctive in the indirect discourse. We've seen indirect discourse before, and we've seen a number of ways in Greek to express it, and one of the ways is using the optative. And so this use of the optative, the oblique optative, because you're kind of dealing with things from an angle, as it were, it's hard to describe this, but when you're dealing with indirect discourse, you're not directly quoting something, but you're saying, this is what they said. And as soon as you do that, in English it's very common to change the tense ideas and so forth. And we've seen that the normal way for that, in one of the previous lessons, was just to use go ahead and use the same tense you would normally use. But they also do this. They also do this thing with optative. And of course, it varies with different writings, too. Luke's writings, especially. It says, this use of the optative, the oblique optative like that described in 2 above, occurs in the New Testament only in Luke's writings. Elsewhere, in indirect discourse, the original mood and tense of the direct discourse are simply retained. That's the thing we talked about earlier, is the fact that in indirect discourse, they'll just go ahead and keep the same tense and mood and so forth that they had in the original statement, and that makes it sometimes difficult, apart from just some context, to tell whether something's direct discourse or indirect. But they will, in Luke's writings, use this optative form. Look at the example, Luke 8:9. Emproton de auton hoi mathetai. Parabole. His disciples asked him what this parable was. Okay, now this is indirect discourse. They asked him what this parable was, is the way we're translating in English, or what this parable might be. Now they use an optative form there in the Greek, so it might translate something like what this parable might be, just to get the expression of the optative. In direct discourse, the Greek and English would be, tis haute esten he parabole. What is this parable? That's what the original statement would have been in an actual quotation. What is this parable? Then an indirect discourse is coming out with the optative. They asked him what this parable might be. Now, if this were not in Luke's writings, you might just see it, you know, the first part of the sentence just as it is, and then tis haute esten he parabole, and just see the normal verb form to be, and then we'd have to translate what this parable was or something. In English, we have to change the tense a little bit or change the verb form in order to express that idea of indirect discourse. Yes, Eric?
In here,
mm-hmm.
That isn't the subjunctive.
No, that's just indicative. In other words, the direct discourse would have been just indicative. It just would have been indicative statement. What is this parable? And then putting in an indirect discourse to go into an optative here. Whereas in the other authors in the New Testament tend to use just the ordinary indicative form for that, for indirect discourse. Okay, an example of indirect discourse without the optative is this, just to remind you of what they look like. Elphontes hoi protoi enomisan hoti pleon lemsontai. When the first ones came, they supposed they would receive more. Notice in English we're translating, they would receive more. What's that lemsontai? Do you recognize that form? What would you?
Lombano.
Huh? Lombano. Yeah, it's from Lombano, and it's irregular, but...
Future?
Yeah, just a future form. Yeah, it's a future form, and it's deponent in the future, unfortunately, so that's why it's got a passive form. But it's a future form. And so, actually, when the first ones came, they supposed that they will receive more. You know, it's actually a future form. But in indirect discourse, you're using indicative forms like that to express it. And the indirect discourse, the English would be pleon lymphsomata, we shall receive more. In other words, that's what they're thinking in their mind. We shall receive more. We shall receive more. And so the indirect discourse, when the first ones came, they supposed, as it were, if you were quotation, they supposed we shall receive more, or they supposed that they would receive more. And that's the idea that they're getting across. So that's an example of just your common type of usage with the indicative. And it may not always be future, it might be just present or something, it's, or even past tense for that matter, depending on what the original statement was in its original connotation. Yes?
The verb there, getting over, getting done. Is that right? They, or is the first one coming?
Oh, yes, to suppose, yeah.
And wouldn't that be they thought? Kind of looking, where is the discourse there? Because
they're
just not a
speech. Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, you got a good point. It's not a statement now, but it's kind of getting a discourse in the mind.
Right.
It's getting what their thought was. And then the whole T is kind of introducing that. They thought that. Yeah, that's where it's coming from there. That's a good point. Generally, most commonly when you're seeing discourse, you're usually seeing a verbs of saying or something, but it can be verbs of thinking too. If we're getting an insight, the author's giving an insight into what's going on in their minds, that can be considered the same way. Okay. Now, there's a remark here too. There was another way for indirect discourse too, and that was use the infinitive. As explained earlier, section 259, part 3, the infinitive with its subject and the accusative may also represent an indirect discourse. And we just remind you one example we had there, Acts 28:6, elegon auton enai theon. They said that he was a god. And there they're using infinitive with an accusative object. And they said him to be a god, you see. So that's another way that indirect discourse can be expressed. Okay. Then in section 388, only one last statement here. In the New Testament, the negative used with the optative mood is always may or one of its compounds. So you're always going to see may or the may forms of the negative associated with the optative, just as you saw with the subjunctive. Yes, Eric?
In the quotation of
the
discourse, they use the present tense?
Well, they'll use either the present tense. When you're doing a direct quotation, they'll use the tense that the person said. In other words, a direct quotation is he said this, and whatever he said, whatever his quote was, whether it was past, present, or future, or even for that matter, if he was making a statement using subjunctive or something like that, you might see it in a direct quotation. For example, well, I guess that one wouldn't be a quotation that was led into, but when they're actually recording actual conversation, it'll be whatever verb form the person said. And then when you use indirect discourse in Greek, generally, more commonly, they'll continue just to do the very same thing, just use the verb form that the person said. But then occasionally they'll use the optative like they do here, or infinitive. Form there too. So another interesting study for someone to do to see how many times they use one and the other. Apparently, of course, somebody studied enough to see that Lucas has a preponderance of using this method. The other ones don't.
Mm-hmm. Here, show me this. You've got a chart optative in the New Testament. He's already done the study.
Oh, has he?
It's
okay.
Split with the indirect question. It's about split with present and aorist. And
okay.
Between everything else and Luke, they're used about half and half. It's only 67 times in the whole New Testament.
Uh-huh. And about half of those are in Luke?
Luke and Acts, it was 28 times. And everywhere else is, what difference? 8 and 31.
Uh-huh.
31 times by Paul. So,
okay. And a lot of those are probably may and never be.
Yeah. Wishes without on.
Uh-huh.
Probably may and never be.
Mm-hmm. What was the split on Aris versus Predin? That was about half and half, too?
About half and half.
And how does Luke how does Luke line up with the rest of those? Is he about half and half in his, too, or is there performance?
Let me put it this way. For Luke, it's about half and half.
Okay.
Or everywhere else, basically all they use is wishes without on, and that's Aris.
Okay.
Always.
Okay.
Matter of fact, all but three times Aris.
Okay. Interesting. So a lot of this looks like stylistic variation too, in a person, in a way a person expresses himself and so forth, can often be the case. And you can even detect that kind of thing when people speak, you know, in English. If you hear certain speakers a lot, so you can pick up the ways that they express things. A lot of people talk in subjunctives and optative ideas, you know, a lot, and might be's and maybe's and that type of thing. And probably if you went to a University of Washington philosophy class, you know, you'd probably see a little bit different sense than you would here. Hopefully you would. Okay. Any other questions on the optative here? Yes, Mark?
One question on Luke 8, 9.
Mm-hmm.
Which way would you translate that? Would you, since it's a present optative,
yeah,
would you translate it might be or maybe?
I think I'd be inclined to say might be. Like this, or find something that would express to me that an optative was used here rather than just the indicative, because you know the fact that it doesn't always use the optative, and here it does use it. I like to get that to come across in my translation somehow. So his disciples ask him what this parable might be. I think that's probably what I would go with, just to get that way. When I see it in English, I'm triggered to expect an optative or something like that in the Greek. Yes.
Go ahead. In all these optatives, they use the combination of might be or would be or should be.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between might be and would be and should be?
Oh, and I don't think there's that much difference. It's just they're trying to do is express the realm of possibility and contrary to fact. In other words, it's not a certainty, but hypothetical. So I think all of those would just be... Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, like would be or should be, the should has kind of an idea of an obligation or some sort of a presumed order of things that ought to be, and would is expressing the same kind of uncertainty, but without those implied obligations, you might say. So I think that's being picked up from the context, whether there's an implied obligation or not, and then deciding how you're going to translate it in English. Well, yeah, I think it's the optative itself has just got the idea of possibility, but you're having to go with optative plus context to decide some of those nuances in English. In other words, whether it's would or should or might, that isn't coming from the optative can cover all of those things, I think, as far as that. But it's not so much that the optative is covering those things, it's the optative plus the context that's deciding what nuance you're going to have. The clause relationship, the structure relationship, whether it's a conditional clause that has a, you know, a prothesis and a podesis, that can help decide whether you're going to have an obligation or not, or what, you know, if there's a cause and effect relationship or at least a presumed one. So I think you're looking at a lot of other considerations besides just the optative form to decide those things. Mm-hmm. Because see, sometimes the optative just can be a plain wish, and you don't have would or could or anything. It's just may this happen, might this happen. And the may, see, has got a different sense to it too than might. May this happen is expressing a wish, where might is just expressing a possibility. And that kind of depends on the clause relationships. And notice when we've broken these down, he's made a point of saying whether it's an independent clause or subordinate clause, or if it's in a situation where you've got a conditional clause and so forth, then you're going to have a little bit different translation of it. So in reality, what we're probably looking at is the optative's got one basic meaning to it that we may not be able to put a label on real easily, because there's nothing that really covers that in English without getting into some of these other areas. So we break it down and say it's using all these different categories. The real meaning of the optative is something more pure, but optative plus all these different contextual relationships, clause relationships, and so forth, results in a total translation for us. Okay, anyone else? Tony.
Just one question on this. In comparing the if-then clause,
mm-hmm,
or the, you know, between that and the subjunctive,
mm-hmm,
would it be right to say or correct to say then that the optative merely states the hypothetical without giving indication one way or other, whereas the subjunctive back here in 374 was saying that the writer was stating his belief of what was correct, yes or no, whereas the opposite just seems to be a flat statement, no writer's input.
Yes, if you go back and look at those page 273, 274, the situation that you see here, types A and B have a condition. Type A is A with the verb in the indicative in any tense, and the conclusion can be in the subjunctive. Type B is on with the verb in the subjunctive. That may be the one we want to look at the most. And see, section 353. Causes, the conditional clauses of type B express conditions which are believed by the speaker to be generally true in the present or probably realizable in the future. So there's a certain kind of an expectation on the part of the reader when he uses subjunctive like this. He either believes that they are generally true or probably realizable. The type C ones use the indicative and a past tense of the indicative. And that's a contrary to fact situation. Now over here with the optative, you're looking at a little bit different, a little bit more remote. It's kind of hypothetically possible, but it doesn't look like the speaker who's making the statement is believing that it's generally true or very probable in the future. He's just saying it's hypothetically possible. So that, you know, it's kind of one step further away from reality. Still possible, but not, there doesn't seem to be the expectation. So here he's hastening to Jerusalem if it were possible for him. You know, there's, when you're reading that statement, you don't get the impression that the person who's writing that feels like it's a certainty or feels like it's highly probable that he's going to get there. But it's possible that he is, and he's trying to do it, you see. And then if you were to suffer, same thing for righteousness' sake. That's got a little bit more remote idea than, say, if you suffer. If you put it in the subjunctive, then you'd be connoting more of an expectation that this is going to happen. And, of course, another scripture might indeed do that, especially in a situation that's really an imminent one as far as persecution is concerned. And, of course, it doesn't even mean to see something in the optative here. It may indeed, from the context, be the case that persecution is imminent. But he's just saying here in a hypothetical sense, in order to get a connection there, even if you were to suffer for his sake, and you might, you know, and you might real soon, you're blessed. Okay? So I think it's the idea of expression of the degree of expectation that's involved is the main difference there. Like I said, if you think of subjunctive more in the realm of probability and optative more in the realm of possibility, just as a real rough and ready distinction between them, it'll be a good guideline at least as to what's going on. Yes?
Yeah, I'm wondering if maybe we could look at Acts 20:16 in a sense of if it were possible for him more as that he was desiring that as a wish rather than ability in terms of getting on a boat on time and making sure the wind's
in blowing. Sure. It's describing his wish and his desire, you know. In other words, it's kind of projecting you into his mind frame of wanting to get there and having that strong desire to get there without any necessary implications as to whether we esteem the probability of it high or not, of him actually doing it. In other words, that's what his wish is, that's what his desire is, that he's working if it were possible, you know, if it's possible, I want to do this. But he doesn't know whether it's possible or not. He's going to give it the old college try, as it were, you see. And there's no real expectation or certain expectation as to what's the case. See, sometimes Paul especially wanted to express, and does so in his epistles very frequently. Like Glenn said, isn't Paul the next most predominant one in Paul's epistles besides Luke? He's often expressing what his wishes or desires are, even when they were contrary to fact. In other words, he told them, you know, how I long to be with you and so forth, but the devil hindered me and that type of thing. And he's doing that quite frequently, letting the people know where his heart is, letting the people know what his wishes are. And that may be one of the reasons why you see a lot of optatives in his writings. Okay? Anyone else?
I just wanted to compare funny brought up page 274.
Mm-hmm.
Compare the example of John 15:20 and 5:8, you're talking about actual apostles.
Okay, type A, okay.
Versus the opposite here in 1 Peter 3:14.
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, he's saying he considers an actual possible putting in a conjunctive, if you persecute me, then I'll persecute you.
Mm-hmm.
But then on 1 Peter 3:14, it's if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you are blessed. So somewhere there's a discrepancy here, you know, in terms of doctrine, I guess.
Okay.
Because on one hand, it's real, actual, possible. You're
going to
be persecuted, yet
mm-hmm.
you're not
going to
suffer?
Oh, no, again, it's not so much whether it's the fact or not. It's a matter of how the statement is being expressed in terms of what's in the mind of the speaker. In other words, using the optative like that, if it were possible, you see, if you should suffer, if you were to suffer, then you are blessed. And he's not saying there that you're never going to suffer. He's just saying if you were to suffer, you'd be blessed. And he's expressing that. And he may be expressing it that way at a time when there's no imminent danger of suffering. But he's just saying that if it ever should come to pass in the future that you should suffer, you'll be blessed. So be assured of this. So he's telling the people that the possibility may be, but it's not an immediate thing as far as what they're facing at the moment. Now, in this type A condition back here in section 352, it's a verb with the indicative in any tense. They're using indicative there for the condition, and that is giving more of a factual sense to the thing. If you are led by the Spirit, you're not in the law. If they persecuted me, see, in there it's using the past tense. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. And when he says if they persecuted me, he's talking from the standpoint that they did in fact do that. That was a historical fact. They did persecute me, and therefore they're going to persecute you also. You can see a future. If all shall be offended in you, I shall never be offended. There again, there's an expectation on the part of the speaker there that the people are going to be offended. Of course, Jesus had just said that they would be. So he says, if this is going to happen, accepting that as fact, then I won't be a part of it. He's saying. So there's some slight differences in nuance. Remember this type A. It's expressing conditions which are believed by the speaker to be actual or possible. Now I see what the problem can come with the word possible there, expressing that it's possible, and then over here it's also got the idea of possibility, but there's still a slightly different sense to it. There's in the type A type clause you sense a more imminent possibility. Something that's more expected, something that's more either already happened, actual, or possible to the point where it's, you know, it's being considered a very real situation that you've got to deal with. Whereas this optative is a little bit more remote as far as the expression is concerned. Okay, John?
In a sense, in stress. In English, we could say, if they persecute me, they will persecute you, or they will persecute you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stressing the fact that it is absolute assured.
Uh-huh.
You know, just by intonation.
Uh-huh.
Now, how would we see this in Greek? Because, see, the will comes from the fact that it's future,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't, if it's just in the future tense, you can't necessarily say that it's an absolute fact.
Right.
It's just something that is future.
That may be done just the same way we do it with intonation. Yeah, because it doesn't seem to be either that, or they would have to break up the sentence and just make two statements. You know, make it first statement: if they persecuted me, they will persecute you, and they will persecute you. You know, and make another statement and make that a fact or something. That could be done. We can do that too. But the trouble when you speculate that it might be intonation is that we don't know what the intonation was. And it'd be nice to have some experience to ask him that right now. See, as far as what modern Greek does, just ask him, what do you do in modern Greek in a situation like that? And when he comes back,
we would... You know, because that's it's
a little different. Well, yeah, do you mean express a wish or desire?
Yeah.
Well, fellow will often do that, right. In fact, fellow sometimes appears in the optative, too, for the same, you know, you kind of get a double whammy on that one, you see. Fellow meaning wish already. There wasn't there an example here?
17:18.
Yeah, 17:18 there. What would this babbler wish to say? I mean, you've got it in the optative, and then you've got fellow there too. So you get the it's a very clear idea of wish or desire there. But you can see fellow without optative forms, and it almost gives you an optative idea just because of the expression of a wish or desire that the verb itself connotes. Okay, so there are some overlaps in the way, and we see that right here in the example of indirect discourse. You know, it's done this way, it's done this way, it's done this way. Well, what's the difference between them? It may be stylistic variation. It may be just, you know, in reading it, I can pick up a slight difference there, but it's a difference that's very hard to describe in words, to find a nice trite sentence, you know, that can express the difference. Some of it is better felt than tell, you know. It's something that's going to come through a lot of reading and exposure to the Greek, and that's what we're about to embark on here, so we can get to fill in a lot of that. So I think that'll help answer some of the questions as far as which you'd be likely to use. Some of it's going to be the way you feel when you're speaking, you know, and the way the person is looking at the thing, the way his perceptions are, the way his expectations are, so forth, are going to come out in the way that it's expressed. And one person may say it this way, another person might say it that way. Yes?
Yeah, I was talking about trying to distinguish these like that. The word possible, I remember this when you were going back over to Site Day there, meant that it was able to happen.
Yes.
Rather than whether an event might occur or not.
Right.
And it's kind of, I don't know if that's real clear.
Yeah.
There's kind of a distinction.
I see what you're saying. The idea of possible meaning capable of happening. In other words, it's not an impossible thing. Possible versus impossible, whether as opposed to the possibility that this might happen in terms of a percentage of a chance that this might happen. In other words, if we want to talk about it in terms of a possibility being a small probability or a weaker probability, that's got a different connotation than the idea of possible versus impossible, whether it's capable of happening, whether it's incapable of happening. And I think that type A type situation is more dealing with the idea of possible in terms of either actual or possible, that is actual or capable of happening, not an impossible situation. Whereas the opposite is kind of dealing with the idea of possibility in the sense of a lower degree of probability, a less degree of certainty, maybe 50-50 chance type of thing, rather than, say, a probability be more like 75% chance or something, you see. In other words, in terms of a quantitative estimate of the degree of probability of an event occurring. See, we can talk about something being possible or impossible, and then we can talk about saying this has got a high degree of possibility or a low degree of possibility. And we're talking on a different vein there. There's a 50% chance of rain tomorrow, you know, which in Seattle means it rains 50% of the time. Okay? All right. Any other questions? Tony?
Well, I got one more.
All right.
On Acts 17:18, with the use of fellow and the opposite, could it be said maybe, if they translated wood here, could it maybe be better translated, what wishes this babbler to wish to say? Or
you could do it this way. What might this babbler wish to say? Put the might in there for the possibility. That's another possibility. The idea, though, is the wish. Okay, it's a possibility for expressing possibility. What might this babbler wish to say? You know, what might this babbler want to say? If he could, you know, what would he be saying? So there's several ways to look at it. It's clearer in Greek than it is in English. You get a certain feeling for it when you read it in Greek, and I don't know how to describe it. It's just that you start thinking it.
Double negative, when we use the double negative, another sense of what, you know, it
somehow
feels like a wish wishing, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
sure. And that certainly comes from the fact that you got fellow, which means to wish anyway, and then you put it in the optative, and that's going to add something to it. And so I don't know how you could express that, a double wishing or something, but it's certainly placed it outside the realm of certainty.
Yeah.
And it's also, it seems to be expressing both the possibility element and the desire element together in this, and it's really hard to put that in a real simple English phrase that covers that. I wish I could somehow express this, but when you read it in Greek, it comes across. If you don't try to translate it in English, just leave it in Greek, it's fine. But trying to put it over in English, it gets into trouble. So I guess we'll just have to rely upon our translation exercises and our work here through the next semester, the rest of the semester and next semester to help give us the feeling for that. And we'll be able to talk to one another in Greek exegesis a lot more freely than we will to other people, that's for sure. It's one of the problems. It's really great to know Greek, but it doesn't do you as much good when nobody else knows. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions there? All right. That finishes up the textbook. We've got 5 more minutes. What I want to do starting... Well, let me assign the exercise for tomorrow. For tomorrow, just... Or I guess Tuesday. Just do part A of lesson 50. All that is just working with the forms. So that... There's just a little chart there and work with the forms. Now, there are exercises on the accents and things in the appendices, and you're welcome to do those. We're not going to take time in class to do them, but you're welcome to do those on your own. And so just do part A, and we'll run through that real quickly on Tuesday. And then starting Tuesday, bring your UBS with you. That's all you'll need. You may want more, but that's all you'll need. And we're going to go through and translate. And I'll have with me a parsing guide and so forth, so we can look up any controversial forms and so forth. And I'm not expecting you, obviously, to know all the vocabulary. We'll start in the Gospel of John, and you'll find that a good percentage of the vocabulary you'll either know, or you know the passage well enough you'll be able to guess what it is. And we're starting off that way just to make it easier. And then, of course, once we get into the book of Hebrews, that'll be a different story altogether. That's supposed to be the most difficult Greek in the New Testament, so I do want to take some time with that. But we'll start with John 1, and we'll start with the areas that you've been reading a lot already, and so you'll have a familiarity with it. And we'll just take it verse by verse and go through the class, and there's no point in trying to do a lot of study ahead of time. I'm mainly interested in pressing us all a little bit to get the recognition and start to think what it's saying and start to flow with Greek thought on it. And then, of course, we will be making comments from time to time on forms that we see interesting things. And we're going to try to refrain from getting too much into theology, but it's real hard to do. And if something is really, there's going to be things you're going to see as you go through the Greek text that you never saw before all the time. And just little things that you know, they're not worth taking a lot of time for in a Pauline epistles class, for example. But they're really interesting. I would love someday to be able to teach the epistles just right from the text, you know. And everybody had the text and everybody follow it, you know. Well, that'd be glorious. Someday we'll have a grad class or something where we can do a little bit of that. But we'll get a taste of it here. We're starting to get into the fun part now. You get through the grammar, now we can get into the real meat of it. So that's the way we'll operate. Now we'll be starting that, and then we'll be starting to work with Dana and Manti a little bit, probably even before the end of the semester. And next semester we'll start with diagramming the first part, and use that to kind of solidify a lot of our grammatical, you know, getting all these rules together in a place where you can graphically see them. And I think diagramming will help just to structure your thoughts in your mind. Some people have never, you know, English diagramming was always a problem to them. I always thought that was the most fun, is to do diagramming English sentences. I guess it's mathematical orientation, but this we're not doing just because it's fun. It's going to be helping solidify. You'll find that they get rather complicated. You thought you saw some complicated diagrams in English grammar, and you haven't seen anything yet. And we'll be getting the machinery. That won't take too long. I'll have to lecture, you know, 2 or 3 days, and giving the basic machinery, and then we'll go through some examples in the scripture, and then let you have your hand at diagramming some of them. And scripture itself, of course, is one of the most difficult things to get diagrammed, especially Paul's epistles. They are so intertwined. Everything connects with everything else. That, you know, as Don has mentioned before, you know, it says wherefore, therefore, and so forth. Everything starts with a therefore, so, or then, or something like that, and it ties you back to the one before, and ties you back to the one before, and eventually you're all the way back to Genesis 1:1, you know. And so it's what you have to do when you're diagramming a sentence is oftentimes leave dangling ends, a dotted line going up to the previous sentence and a dotted line going to the next one, and that's is kind of the conventional way to do it. So we'll get into that. Now, as far as grading is concerned, we'll have this one quiz coming up, what, next Thursday did we sign? Mm-hmm. Next Thursday on those others, and then there'll probably be one more quiz. I want to cover the perfect and pluperfect forms and a few of these other details that we've covered. I'm not so sure about the optative forms. I may give you a few to recognize or something. I'll tell you more detail there, but there'll be one more quiz there, and that'll probably be it as far as tests for this semester. Because then we'll start translating. We'll get into Dane and Matty. Most of that information I'll test you on next semester. But next semester also, we're going to start looking at these principal parts and use that as a vocab quiz, periodic vocab quizzes on the principal parts. Okay, we'll take... leave now, and Tuesday we'll go through that optative thing first. No, no. If you've never done any English diagramming, or in your case, Swedish diagramming,
we never did.
Yeah, if you didn't, don't worry about it. I'm going to start from ground zero, and in fact, this will be a little bit different than the way it's done in English anyway. Slightly different, so I don't think you have anything to worry about. We're going to define every term and start from zero. Okay.
Observation: I wasn't here yesterday. I knew you'd be going through this, but I spotted a discrepancy in here on the list that I caught.
Oh.
The article does not exist in Matthew 24:20.
Oh.
He colored his.
It was just Sabato.
Yeah, it was just Sabato. And this one here, we just stuck a necktie up there by itself, actually has Tau Te Ching necktie in it, which has a slightly different flavor than if you just say necktie by itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way he was translating it at night would be fair. But it's interesting because of the way that it says this to the night.
Mm.
You know, in other words, what I'm saying is the reason we can say at night is because it's saying this.